This isn't fly, this is Molly.
With style.
That you make me, it is just to go crazy. The sense that you're not making,
the liberties you're taking, leaves my goddess is shaking. You are just un poco loco.
It's the 19th episode of Falling with Style. I'm Doug,
and I'm Derek.
And this is an ongoing Pixar movie marathon podcast. Each episode is dedicated to exactly one movie in the Pixar Animation Studios canon. Today we're talking about a Pixar film both of us have been excited to talk about since we started the podcast, the closest Pixar has ever come to making a musical, and currently the winningest film ever at the Annie Awards, which I only just recently learned.
Oh, wow.
In fact, there are very few awards this movie didn't win that season.
Wow. Okay.
We are talking about Coco. Coco's story was conceived by Lee Unkrich and developed by a number of folks. It was written by Adrian Molina and Matthew Aldrich, produced by Darla K. Anderson, and directed by Unkrich and Molina. Coco was released widely on November 22nd, 2017, about 5 months after Cars 3. And prior to preparing for this conversation, Doug had seen it a handful of times. And Derek, I know this is one you've seen. I just don't know how much.
This is only my second time seeing it.
Okay, so, gotcha. Yeah. Cool. Well, I'm glad this is how we get to revisit it. But yeah, we are not revisiting it just the two of us. We have a guest for this episode, and a guest I'm really excited to have because this is a friend of mine that I used to work with who we were working together when this movie was like marketing and coming out, and we talked about it as it was, you know, rearing to come out and after it came out, and I remember them being very excited about it. We are joined today by my friend Stefania. Hello, Stefania.
Hello. How's it going?
It's going well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to be here talking about Coco.
Yeah, I'm pumped to have you here. Like I said, you and I talked a bunch leading up to this movie because I was always stoked for a Pixar movie. And I remember you and I having conversations about this. So I'm curious, do you have much of a history with Pixar in general? Or is it just like a studio that makes movies that you saw and then Coco was one that sort of caught your attention?
So I think for me, you know, Pixar has always been there, even just growing up. Like I remember, like if you remember A Bug's Life, like that was my jam, right? Like I just remember I would collect all the collectibles at like the Disney store or or even I remember us talking about Pixar at the lunch table and ranking like the Pixar movies. I had a hot take where I said Toy Story was boring. I know.
Oh, I don't remember.
I don't know
that
if you want to go there.
I blacked it out.
But no, I was really excited to see Coco come out just based on like my cultural background. And for me, it was just something really exciting because I hadn't really seen, you know, the Mexican culture, Latino culture really represented in these types of films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And that's a huge conversation that was happening leading up to the movie. I remember it being sort of a conversation when they announced that they were going to make a movie based on Dia de los Muertos. Or I think as the movie calls it, just Dia de Muertos, which I didn't realize. I don't know if there's an official ruling on that or not. But I remember when they announced that they were making a movie about the holiday and people were sort of struck by it. And I think there was maybe some initial concern because Pixar hadn't done a movie that,
right,
you know, delved into a culture so deeply. And what was it actually going to be? And I think the reception was actually pretty good. Very good, actually. So
yeah, really positive. Mm-hmm.
I think this also kind of kicks off. It doesn't necessarily kick off on its own because Moana came the year before it, but it does kick off sort of an era of some of these larger studios sort of unabashedly digging deeply and responsibly into specific cultures as opposed to just like borrowing their stories, which is very cool. And I think Coco probably set some precedents, I think, you know, as to how things should be done as best as they can be.
Yeah.
So do you remember, Stefania, much of leading up to this movie or your reaction to the movie or even just going to the movie and what that was like?
Yes. So I do remember when it came out, I actually took my parents also. Mm-hmm. My folks, you know, were from a Mexican culture. Both of my parents are immigrants. They both migrated here from Mexico themselves. And for me, I was just really excited because growing up, anytime a new like Disney movie would come out or Pixar movie, you know, they would take me to the theater, and that was like a very special outing. And so when this movie came out and I knew that I was going to focus on, you know, the Day of the Dead, you know, I wanted to take them, you know, just as like a special trip for us to experience the movie together. And I think afterwards, like we were all just super, it was like emotional. It was like funny. But it's just so many different like cultural recognitions of just, you know, different musicians, different or just even traditions. Right. Mm-hmm. I think was really interesting to see for the first time.
Yeah.
What were do you remember what your parents' reactions to it were? Or were there things that you remember them being like especially struck by?
Yeah. So there were definitely moments like during the film where things were like, for example, the grandma that comes out at the beginning, mm-hmm. She very much embodies what my grandma is in terms of like always making sure you're fed well. Right. Like there, she's going to take no for an answer. Like, you know, she's going to keep feeding you and super strict. There's like one scene where she like throws her sandal at a mariachi guy, and like, yeah, 100%. Like my grandma did that, you know, with like my, you know, aunts and uncles and stuff. Or like different cultural references. A lot of when they do like the black and white sort of screens, or like when the TV shows and they're doing different scenes from like the movies, like black and white.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, oh, that's like so-and-so, or, oh, like that, you know, reminds me of, you know, this artist, you know, from back in the day. So it was really cool just to kind of pick up on some of those cultural references that they mostly resonated with.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, it's very cool. Very, very cool.
And it's all stuff that I still like have to be told is there. Like every time I look into this movie, I'm like learning something new, which is exciting.
Yeah, same here.
And it's a lot of the little things, right? Like one of the characters is wearing a Mexico soccer jersey. Like mm-hmm. that's so cool. Like it's just a little detail, but like that's the thing, right? Like if you travel to Mexico anywhere, like you see guys wearing the soccer jerseys, and that's a very popular thing. And for them to like pick that up and put that in the movie, I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Never would have caught a detail like that myself. That's really cool that's like based in reality. That's so cool.
The jersey stood out to me for some reason this time watching it. And it must have been something you brought up to me at some point, because I was like, why am I thinking about this guy in the jersey? Because it's like one of his uncles, right? Or I think it's one of his uncles.
Yeah, it's not like a main character or anything. He's just kind of in the background. But yeah, he's wearing like the soccer jersey, and like it stands out, right? Like, oh yeah, like that's really cool, right? That, you know, they did that.
Yeah. Derek, do you remember, you said you saw it once before. Did you see this one in theaters, or is this one you saw after the fact?
I saw it after the fact. I don't remember how long afterwards. I couldn't have been that much longer afterwards, because I heard so much good stuff about it. But maybe it was, now that I'm thinking about it, it might have been a couple of years after it was out. Either way, it definitely wasn't in theaters, but it has still been a few years since I last saw it. So I loved it. I don't have any hot takes on it. It's a good movie. Made me cry. No notes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like this is the kind of movie that is worth like raising your eyebrow at somebody if they have a hot take about it. If they're like, Coco was bad, actually. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Like every movie has, I'm sure there's always some conversation to be had. And you know, even Coco, just like how it came to be and who the first people involved, like it's worth asking some questions, right? Because the first people involved were not Mexican Americans or Mexican creators or filmmakers, but they did a lot, as Pixar tends to do, especially in the modern era, to recognize like who they were and who they needed involved. And it sounds like it came across the right way to folks, and that they nailed it.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I know there was some controversy around it at the time, but some stuff that maybe wasn't even really related to them. Like I know there was like the Disney trying to copyright Dia de los Muertos thing that happened. That's not Pixar's fault,
weird.
But it's still like, yeah. Right. It's still a weird thing kind of tied to this movie.
Yeah. There's like not, there's not a lot of controversy, when it comes to Coco, luckily. But that's certainly one of the earliest things, because before the movie had a name, people were like, why is Disney trying to copyright the name of a holiday? You know, like one that's very culturally significant. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea was that maybe they wanted to call it that, or like the movie Dia de los Muertos, or incorporate it in the name, or Disney being Disney could have just straight up wanted to copyright it like they did Hakuna Matata. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they didn't, luckily. I don't think that those trademarks were granted. I'm not sure.
Probably not, yeah.
No. I remember people fighting, like artists fighting back against that. Yeah. Just being like, are you kidding me? Like, come on, Disney.
Yeah. pretty silly stuff. Well, the movie does come, like I sort of alluded to, the movie doesn't necessarily come from where you would expect. Lee Unkrich, the director of the movie, is notably not Mexican or Latino at all. But he is the one who conceived the idea. But the way that he talks about it, he does speak about it with a lot of care and responsibility. And a lot of interviews, he basically said, you know, from the moment I pitched this as one of three ideas, you know, to John Lasseter, and he said that one, I knew, like, oh shoot, what have I gotten myself into? Like, am I the right person to tell this story? Mm-hmm. And they took a lot of care along the way. One of the people, obviously, like, very involved in making sure that was the case is the co-director Adrian Molina. And I've mentioned him before because when we talked about Ratatouille, I think I threw his name in there because his first job at Pixar was as an animator on the end credits of that movie, which is notable because they're traditionally animated. It stands out for Pixar.
Right.
But Molina has a really cool story here that I definitely want to share. He was initially a story artist on Coco by request. He said, I heard you're making a movie about Day of the Dead and about a Mexican family. I want to be involved as a Mexican-American, you know?
Fair.
And so, and he suspects that they were going to seek him out anyway, but he sounds like a very go-getter type of guy because in a special feature, he mentioned that during the development of the story, as story challenges would arise, he would go home and try to solve them and then basically build new pitches or pitches that would work based on the solutions he was coming up with. And then he would email them to Lee Unkrich and say, you don't have to do anything with this. I just was thinking about it, but you know, I think maybe this could work. And that ultimately led to him being one of the screenwriters and then eventually co-director of the film. So dude shot his shot.
Nice.
And it worked. And I'm glad that it worked.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm sure the movie was all the better for it. So.
Oh yeah. 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 He ended up writing some of the lyrics to songs too. And ooh, you know, wow. There are a lot of special features that highlight a lot of the folks involved in this movie that kept Pixar on track in doing it right. Mm-hmm. So I know even if you just look at the special thanks at the end of the movie, there's like 25 cultural advisors, which feels very notable, like individual cultural advisors that were thanked, which feels notable because I was just listening to a podcast about Zootopia where they had like one consultant.
Oh, and it kind of shows
like race relations.
Yeah.
And then Pixar's like, we have 25 individual people. And then they also like thank 30 families from Mexico that like that they visited or who welcomed them into their homes and like highlighted where they were from. They had like 15 separate locations throughout Mexico that they cited in the credits. And they actually had, it sounds like multiple events is maybe not the right word, but multiple occasions where they invited any Pixar employee in any position who identified with the culture being represented in the film to watch the film and give them like really honest feedback. And there was some lady, I wish I had written down her name, who worked in like the cafeteria who was like, I gave them really tough feedback. And I was like, good, you're awesome. So
love that.
That's cool.
They definitely did a lot. So I guess where it's a really rich movie story-wise, like visually, thematically, musically. So where do we want to jump in first? I mean, what makes sense to start with?
Well, something that stood out to me with this film, and you can kind of see it in some of the newer Pixar movies as well, I feel like there's a very much a women playing a strong role in like supporting their family.
Mm-hmm.
Right. you can sort of see that in some of these other films that are out now. But for me, that's something that has stood out, right? Especially like as they're going through, you know, great-great-grandmother created this business for her family, you know, to support them. And it's become a long-term tradition, right, to make the shoes, and that's what they do. That piece for me kind of stood out because tradition is very much a strong aspect of Mexican culture in terms of like the women taking care of the family, you know, playing that role. And so it was just interesting to see how kind of that played out and how much of a influence that has on the other characters, right? Of like, this is your job. This is what we do to support our family, you know, and kind of it keeps going on generation to generation. So that's something that kind of stood out to me.
Yeah, I feel like the movie does a really incredible job showing you it's a matriarchal system without telling you, like, the women are in charge.
Yeah.
Like, you just know it very quickly.
Yes.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's something that we've tracked with the Pixar movies as we've been doing this podcast, is sort of like they haven't always been great at representing women in general, really. Like, there's often very few of them. And, you know, this movie is still, the primary character is a boy and he's mostly hanging out with his dad. But even in spite of that, there's a really rich cast of like really well fleshed out female characters in this movie that still makes it, I feel like, stand apart from a lot of what we've been getting, especially like the past couple of movies that we've covered that have like mother characters played by like really huge actresses who are given nothing to do. Like they have no personality outside of like, that's the mom, I guess. And like, that's not at all the case in this movie. Like the women are so, are like kind of the most fleshed out of the characters outside of the actual protagonist, you know?
And I think it's notable that we get a grandmother, a great grandmother, and a great, great grandmother, and they all have different personalities. Like it shouldn't be, you shouldn't have to say it, but given what you're talking about, Derek, like, it's worth pointing out.
Yeah.
Do you have any favorite family members, either in the living world or in the land of the dead, Stefania?
Oh, that's a tough one.
It's a big cast.
Yeah. There's just so many. I mean, I feel like you gotta love Miguel, right? Like, he's going through this journey. He's trying to voice, you know, his passions. And as someone who is like, you know, the next generation, right? Like trying to break from tradition or break from the rules, right? It can be tough, you know, even for myself, right? Like I'm the oldest daughter in the family. And so when you're trying to break from tradition or break from whatever they designate as like rules, right? That can be challenging or there can be pushback. And you can obviously see that in the film when, you know, Miguel wants to play music and, you know, his grandma for sure is like, no, you're not, you know, like, I don't know who you think you are, but like, no.
Yeah. Where'd you get that idea?
Yeah, exactly. So for me, like, I guess his role in like the journey that he takes on, you know, it resonated for me in that way.
Miguel is a really great character in this movie because it is, I think, often a really hard balance to strike with a kid who's like whole deal is being kind of stubborn in some regards, you know, like you obviously want to sympathize with him because it's like, yeah, let this kid play music. Like, come on, y'all are being ridiculous. But he also like instigates the entire conflict of the movie. He could have very easily just gone back home and lived his life. And like,
yeah,
the
whole movie
only happens because he's like, no, I'm going to play music. Leave me alone. I'm running away. And that, and if that isn't executed well, it could just be an annoying kid. And he's not. I think part of that is they write him very relatably. And I think the actor who plays him is very, very good too.
Oh man. Can I tell you that the actor that plays Miguel, Anthony Gonzalez, was initially a temp voice. They initially hired him to read lines for when they were animating and stuff like that. And they just liked him so much that they were like, you know what? We got to keep this kid on. He's too good.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. He's awesome.
Amazing. Cause he's a good singer too.
Yeah.
Well, so that's what's wild is they didn't even, I don't think they even realized this when they brought him on, but he the kid, like actual kid Anthony Gonzalez, had been singing mariachi since he was like very, very young. So they like lucked into a situation where they had like a good kid voice actor who also genuinely was a singer in a Mexican tradition.
That's like, so funny. God, imagine, like, that's got to be so nice where it's just like, all right, you're coming as the temp, or we'll pay you a little paycheck, but it's not going to be you. And then it's just like, actually, never mind. This is all permanent. You're a star now.
Yeah, it was all part of the plan. That's fine.
There's a very cute special feature on the Blu-ray that I have that is them like delivering the news to him and his mother who's nearby that he got like the permanent part. It's very sweet.
Oh, that's cute.
I love that.
But yeah, he's really fantastic. Most of, like you said, Derek, most of the time is spent between like Miguel and Hector, who big twist, everybody. Hope you watch the movie. I don't know why you're listening to this if you haven't watched it, because it's really good. But the whole big twist is that, you know, Hector's actually his dad. Or not, or his dad, but his relative. Yeah, his grandfather.
Great-great-grandfather, yeah.
Yes. Oh, gosh, there's so many generations.
I know.
You know, I just call it, I just like, I'm just like, his dad. Because he's right. Kind of in the, it's the searching father for figure. Your long-lost father kind of role. Even though Miguel has a dad who's in his life, it's still basically that same story, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, we find out that he's actually the great grandfather. I remember when I saw the movie for the first time being really surprised. Like, I did not think that they had given that many clues, but I'm curious, Stephanie, if that was something that you saw coming. Were you gagged? Like, what would you remember your reaction?
Honestly, like, I was kind of shook because I did not see it coming, because they hype up, I'm forgetting the name, but the one musician, right? The famous musician.
Oh, De La Cruz.
De La Cruz, yeah. So they're, you know, they hype him up as this like super awesome guy, super talented. So when they're at that scene when they're in his like mansion, right, like at the party, and he's and then like Hector confronts him. I mean, that was like intense. That was like a for sure like telenovela like feature. You know, it was like I was living for it. But I did not see it coming, I guess.
Yeah, that's so fun. See, for me, I kind of clocked pretty early, I think, that Hector was going to turn out to be his relative, just because it kind of made, just because of the way that it would make perfect sense, right? The kid gets to hang out with this guy for most of the movie, and then it turns out they've been getting to know each other. Oh, you were related all along. Isn't that a nice, like, I just kind of figured that would be, because that's not a, like an uncommon kind of twist. But the execution of it, I think the thing that really shook me was De La Cruz not just being like not related to Miguel and not just being not a great guy, but being like an actual murderous villain. That's what got me. And the fact that, you know, we've come to expect with Pixar that they will do some dark stuff. They will do some mature types of things. But I do think that there is something to an actual cold-blooded murderer that is very explicitly revealed as a murderer.
Like, and who doesn't back down from being a murderer? It's not like he doesn't think he's murdering people. It's that he thinks it's justified.
Yeah. Yes. And it's not anything cartoonish about it. He just straight up poisoned his friend as anyone would in any real murderer could in real life, and then stole his life from him. And then it's just like, I mean, yeah, I did what I had to do. Like, I guess I wasn't expecting like the no punches pulled kind of execution with him, because Pixar movies sometimes just don't really have villains in the same, they might have an antagonist, but they don't really have a straight villain. And I think that twist is really well executed, and the sort of sinisterness is something that I don't think you see very often in Pixar.
I think it benefits this movie in a way that is clearer to me retroactively than even in the moment. Because I think one of the reasons I didn't see it coming is because the movie was already pretty layered in its story, and the way that they wove things together was already like pretty complex. But I think retroactively now in the year 2022, when conversations are starting to pop up about like, are animated movies just making matriarchs bad guys? Like, I think this movie benefits from having an actual villain, like actual cold-blooded murderer villain, to remind you that like, no, actually, like, there are bad people, like, who aren't just your strict mother or grandmother or great-grandmother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was like, I would do it again, right? Like, he was, like, not remorseful. Like, yeah, I'm like, I had to do what I had to do.
Yeah. He pushes him off a cliff. Like, he pushes Miguel off a cliff. He pushes a 12-year-old kid off a cliff. Like, yeah, that's a bad guy. I mean, that's a classic Disney villain move, honestly. Like,
yeah, throwing somebody off of something really high.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I guess who else really stands out? I mean, obviously, Mama Imelda, who, by the way, I for anybody who listens to both shows that Derek and I do, if you listen to our Spider-Man podcast, worth mentioning, Mama Imelda is voiced by Alana Ubach, who voices one of my favorite characters from Spectacular Spider-Man, Liz Allen.
Yeah.
But anyway, I do love that character. She's fantastic. Mama Imelda, that is.
Yeah, I love that she got like a kind of like her 15 minutes of fame a moment, like towards the end when she's like singing on stage. I loved that.
She gets a whole character arc. I love it. I mean, and it's like with not a ton of, she's not in this movie a lot. Like, she's a presence, but she really doesn't have a lot of screen time. But she's changed by the end of the movie. She's like, she's very different from beginning to end. And I think it's in a way that like feels very organically done. And again, is not what a lot of like mother figure characters in a lot of other Pixar movies have been able to have. So like, I think she's handled extremely well.
I think she's also allowed to have that journey over a period of time that isn't just like a moment of revelation, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think the fact that she says that thing of, you murdered the love of my life, and then from that moment forward, she's trying to figure out what that even means.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where she's like, wait, am I changing? Am I seeing this differently?
Yes.
I just think the entire setting of the afterlife in this movie is really fun and cool. And I love the idea that after you die, you just get to like hang out as a skeleton for and just live your life as a skeleton. Like, that seems rad, man. Like, that's a pretty cool version of the afterlife. But even with that said, I think that like the sort of rules of it that, you know, you're sort of existing and thriving only on memory, you know, so you still have this sort of attachment to the world. Like, I think that that's actually really fascinating. That sort of existential question and like the importance of being remembered, you know, from your previous life and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely is kind of a thinker.
Yeah, and I feel like that plays into like the emotional aspect of the film, right? Because then you start thinking about, well, at least for me, I always cry in movies, so that's just like a natural thing. but I do feel like having that, you know, almost as a guideline, right? If like if people start forgetting you in the living world, right, like then you start to fade away. So I thought that was kind of interesting how they created that. I also just love the visual aspect of it, like the bright colors, especially with like the alebrijes, we know, like the really bright colored spiritual animals. Like, I think that was really cool to incorporate that in that world.
Yeah, all of the design elements of how the entire world looks, and like you said, like the bright colors of everything, so beautiful, and like so kind of unlike really anything that I feel like we've seen from Pixar, at least up to this point, and from a lot of movies, really, just the whole aesthetic of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the amount of stuff that I only really know about because of Coco, and then went on to learn more about because of Coco, like the list is so long. Like, you mentioned the alebrijes, like I'd never heard of those. I didn't know what they were. And so being introduced to what they are, the spirit animals, the spirit guides, like in that particular context, and then to learn after the fact that they're not even necessarily associated with Day of the Dead, but they worked really well into like the afterlife world and all that.
Sure.
Like,
yeah,
it was a cool thing to learn about. Or the ofrendas, like I don't think any movie I've watched has made me so deeply question my own relationship with the concept of an afterlife and what it means for the actual people in my life.
Yeah.
Like Coco has.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Like every time I watch this movie, I'm like, I should call a relative or something.
Sure.
Yeah, it's, I think it's just interesting because so different parts of Mexico celebrate Day of the Dead differently, right? So like, for example, like in my family, we don't necessarily do an altar, right? Like we kind of acknowledge that the holiday is happening, but there were never any like real, you know, traditions or things around that like we did here at home. But mm-hmm. after seeing the film, it like it intrigued me to like look into that and like actually incorporate that, you know, as part of like an acknowledgement or recognition when the holiday comes around.
Mm-hmm.
Because the scenes where they're like showing like the cemetery and there's families gathered around and they're, you know, having dinner, like that is a very normal thing in certain parts of or certain regions of Mexico where they will literally like make a full dinner, go to the cemetery site and eat by their loved ones that have passed away. And so I think that's a really, it's an interesting take on, you know, how we view death or what does that mean, you know, for the family members who are no longer here with us.
Yeah, it's very cool. And it's so, I mean, it is so vastly different, I know, from like a lot of ways that I think like American culture kind of deals with death and deals with, I mean, extended family in general, I guess, really. Like, I know that in my experience, like my family has never really given a lot of thought, like once a relative that isn't in your immediate family has kind of died, I feel like it's just like, well, we're never going to think about them ever again unless a story happens to come up, which is like really sad to think about that. You know,
yeah,
that's not a thing that I ever thought about because that's just like the culture that I've been raised in. Like, that's right. Just how my family operates. But then you see this movie and the way that they sort of embrace, like they know stories and people from generations back. And like, I would have to like do research to figure mm-hmm. out who my great, great grandparents are. And it's sort of like bizarre that it's like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. There were two things from various interviews and special features that really stuck out to me with regards to what you're talking about, Derek, and kind of how you were saying, Stephanie, the traditions are sort of carried out around Day of the Dead. And one of them was like a really brief snippet of a conversation that they had with a woman in Mexico when they were doing like research, doing one of their research trips. And she was like, so matter of factly, like, when I die, don't forget me. Don't mm-hmm. don't stop thinking about me. Don't yep. don't treat me like I'm not a part of your life. Like, you know, yep. that's no one wants that. And then the other one was one of the screenwriters, Matthew Aldrich, said that he was having a conversation with somebody in Mexico on one of those research trips. And he was really caught off guard when they asked him what his family and what his sort of upbringing thought about the afterlife and death, because that's a question he had asked them. They kind of like threw it back at him like, okay, well, what about you? And he described like, you know, what cemeteries that sound like cemeteries I grew up with, right, from a really Eurocentric Catholic background, where he was like, you know, in the years following somebody's death, you might go back once a year on the day that they died, and then maybe you start skipping years, and then you sort of just stop going. And she just replied, that's really sad. And I was like, that is really sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because like I have family members who will say, you know, like when I pass away and I, you know, if I get cremated, take my urn to parties, right? Like bring my urn to like put me in as a centerpiece and like let me just be at the party with you all, you know?
I don't want to miss out.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it is interesting the, you know, just different perspectives, right? Based on the culture.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I like that it has that sort of effect. It sounds like for people who didn't grow up with any of these traditions, but it also sounds like even for folks who might have grown up with some of them, mm-hmm. but not all of them, which is really, really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned, Stephanie, just like the look of the afterlife. I was blown away by that wide shot of the Land of the Dead when yeah. they first show you. I was like, oh my god, how did they do this?
Yeah, no, that was so cool. And just because it's also something that, like, I mean, it's just out of their imagination, right? Like, I'd never had thought about it looking like that, right? Like depending on your background or religion, right? You're told one thing, but this was just so cool to see. It's like a city, right? Like it's like mm-hmm. a huge city and the colors, and you see like the little like trains going around, and you know, it's like, it's a busy atmosphere. And so I think that was really cool to see how they're navigating through, or even when they're at the plaza and they've got like the battle of the bands, you know, like they're just hanging out, having parties, you know.
They're like living full lives in death.
It's so cool. Yeah. It's so cool. And I just love, I mean, again, I love that they're all skeletons. I think that's so fun. But also from the animation side, like animating all of these skeletons and so the cool things that they do with them that you could only do if you were like characters that could just pull body parts off of yourself seamlessly. Like it's, they do so many fun things with it. And I have to imagine that was a challenge for them because they've never done anything like that before.
Oh yeah, big time. We've pointed out a couple things from certain movies that like Pixar directors or writers will point to, like the technical department being like, "Excuse me, you want to do what? Like, I'm sorry, you want to do with what?" And I have to imagine an entire movie full of skeletons where each bone is an individual object, because each one of those bones is an individual object in that virtual space. I'm sure that they needed some time to process.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that they all look different.
Yeah.
Right? They all have their own aesthetic or personality or style. Like, I think that is really cool and how they did that.
And you know what? This is fascinating. So there is a really, really great, wherever you can find it, special feature on the costuming of this movie. Mm-hmm. And they said it was so important, one, to just clothe everybody, because a bunch of skeletons, no matter how diverse you make them, are going to kind of all look like skeletons from afar.
Mm-hmm.
But although they do actually, what's weird, this movie that features so many skeletons does body diversity better than so many other movies. And they're literally not bodies.
Yes.
They're just skeletons.
Honestly though.
Right? But there's an amazing feature on clothing, because there were so many technical challenges around clothing with regards to the fact that, like, okay, Miguel is a human boy with a full fleshy body, and his clothes were a challenge because clothes are a challenge. He only has one surface. Like, the outside of his body is one surface. Imagine taking that and multiplying it by however many bones. Like, the computer just went haywire and was like, I don't know what to do. So they had to figure that out. But from an aesthetic standpoint, one thing that I never would have thought about, the skeletons in the Land of the Dead, they don't all wear fashion from the same eras because they didn't all die at the same time, but they do wear fashion that goes back a very specific amount of generations, because the assumption, the sort of sad assumption is like, the longer time passes, the more likely folks will be forgotten and have that permanent death. So it makes sense that like their fashion in the afterlife goes back X number of generations, back to about Victorian era.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, that makes a lot of sense.
It's wild. I never would have thought of it.
Yeah. Well, and the only time that wouldn't be the case is if you were a famous person.
Right.
I think it's really fascinating. Do you know what time period this movie is supposed to take place in? Is it just like present day? Like,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's just supposed to be modern day. Because in Miguel's town, everybody for the most part is wearing like contemporary clothing.
That's what I thought. Yeah. I just remember seeing the scene like in De La Cruz's party, and they just like, there's actually a DJ with like scratching records.
Yeah, did that guy die like yesterday?
Right. It's like, oh wow, okay. Yep. I love that. I love that kind of mismatch of like time periods in the afterlife because of that. It's so fun. It's
yeah, really that's great. Definitely something I didn't think about now that you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. It's like, it's a thing where I might have noticed that some people were wearing contemporary clothes and some people were wearing older clothes, but just like how specifically thought out that idea of like, you know, these are the eras that would make sense. It just never would have occurred to me. It's so cool. You mentioned that DJ, Derek. Mm-hmm. This reminds me, I don't know. I think that these are supposed to be like permanent features of their skeleton bodies. But the reason I'm thinking of it is because the DJ had like an ornate beard on his skull, but he like clearly had a beard, but it was just like decorations. Like, I don't know how else to describe it. Like, I don't know if they were carvings or paintings, but all the characters have like different specific, you know, designs and coloring just on their bones and on their skulls and stuff, which is really cool. It's just another thing that sets different skeleton characters apart.
Right. Well,
and I think that is, it aligns with the Day of the Dead tradition, because typically during the holiday, people will put on face paint to look like skeletons, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's part of the tradition. So I do think it's a neat detail that they added on to the different skeletons, right? Like especially some of the main characters, of just like the different colors or essentially like the ornate detailing, mm-hmm. right, on the skeleton. I thought that was cool because that is part of the tradition, the holiday of people dressing up as skeletons and having those, you know, intricate face paintings.
Yeah. I mean, we already kind of brought it up, but the first thing that I saw in my notes was just how cool Pepita, was that her name?
Yeah,
yeah.
Pepita.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. So cool. And like her and Dante too. I guess that's a whole conversation. Mm-hmm. my God. I love, like, you know, the animal sort of companions in like Disney and Disney adjacent type movies, like sometimes can be annoying. Not the case in this movie. I think mm-hmm. they could help kill it. And I love that Pepita is like really menacing at first, and then it's just basically just a friendly cat. Like that's it. I love that.
That's such a fun moment at the end when you see its shadow and then it's just a cat.
No, those were really cute. And Dante in particular, so I didn't know this until after I watched the film the first time, but the type of dog type or breed that Dante is actually a very, I don't know if you all know this, but the type of breed that Dante is stems all the way back to the Aztec times.
Whoa.
Really?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah. Wow. So there's a specific breed and they're still alive, right? Like this breed is still, but it's very rare and they look just like Dante. Like they have no hair, right? They're like gray or black. They have a very distinct face. But it's said that their breed can be traced back all the way to the Aztec time. And so it kind of brings an interesting spin, right? Of like Dante is a spirit animal, right? Yeah. And so how long has Dante, you know, been, you know, alive or dead, right? Because he goes in between, but.
That's so cool. Yeah, no, that feels so intentional. I love that.
Yeah, and I didn't know that until afterwards because my dad was like, oh yeah, like that's like that type of dog, and I was like, wow, I had no idea. but I think it was intentional, and if you look them up, they're not cute dogs, right? Like they don't look very cute, but the fact that like their breed has been, you know, alive for that long, I think is really cool.
Yeah
that's wild.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Fascinating. The only other spirit animal note that I had that I love the sort of mundane things they're doing in almost like a Flintstones way sometimes, like the porcupine one that's like serving appetizers at Taylor Cruz's party.
Yes, oh, I love the porcupine one. Oh, it would be so difficult. Well, I guess if you're a skeleton, it doesn't matter. But I just was trying to imagine taking the you know, appetizer off the porcupine and trying not to poke myself.
Yeah.
The advantage of being a skeleton, ain't got to worry about it.
I know, right? There was one Easter egg among the Alebrijes. Well, actually, there were two among the Alebrijes. There was one in the living world with the Alebrijes figurines. Nemo was in there as one of them.
Okay.
But like a stylized Nemo, so it wasn't just like thrown in there like a toy. And then Kevin from Up, the bird, is an Alebrije on De La Cruz's piano during the montage of everybody singing Remember Me over and over again.
Okay.
Oh, so, interesting.
Yeah, they threw a couple animal references in there, made them spirit guides.
Kevin makes sense because Kevin was already kind of weird looking anyway. So like, of course.
Already very exaggerated and colorful.
Right.
I think another big aspect of this film is just the music in general.
Oh my gosh.
Right? And because they do lean towards the more traditional like mariachi style, but like when they're at the Battle of the Bands, right? Like you're going through the different musical styles, regional sounds, right? And even just like rock, right? Like they have that band. And I think they did a really great job at the music, the songwriting, because I think they played really well with the traditional sounds, the regional sounds. And also like the song La Llorona, right? The one that Mama Imelda sings, that's a really famous song, right, in the culture. And so for them to incorporate that in the film, I think also resonated with a lot of folks too.
So, okay, this is me being a dummy. So that was not a song written for the movie. That's like a famous song already.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
So there's like a mythical story to La Llorona. La Llorona means like the woman who's crying. And essentially there's like this like myth that this woman, you'll hear this woman crying in the streets, you know, either for her family, like her kids, or, you know, something that like, it's kind of like one of those like spooky tales, right? That your grandparents will tell you like, oh, be careful because, you know, La Llorona, you're going to hear her, like, you know, like that kind of stuff.
No.
Yeah.
You're going to hear this woman crying like in the streets, but it's kind of based along those lines. Yeah.
I learned about La Llorona from Riverdale because a recent Riverdale episode had La Llorona in it.
You know, I should have, I don't know why I didn't pick up on that. There was, there were a couple, if not more than a couple, La Llorona, like horror movies that all came out around the same time. And I haven't seen any of them.
I'm sure they're all
fantastic.
That
makes sense now that you tell me a little bit about like what that folktale is.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Now, I don't think the song necessarily connects to that fully, right? But the concept of like, you know, shoot, like Mama Imelda is a woman who had a lot of sorrow in her life, right? She lost her husband and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's such a good point.
And yo, I don't know, like we talked about, you know, the big twist and you know, Hector's relation to Miguel and all that, but I don't know if we necessarily did justice to like just the sheer poetry of the story, you know, like the fact that one, you already have Hector and Miguel who have these intertwined goals, right? Even if they never ended up being related, their goals are intertwined. But then for it all to come around on the fact that like Mama Imelda was affected in this particular way because of this thing that happened, that also is the reason why he can't get back to the world of the living, which also coincides with the fact that the one person who would remember him theoretically will, like, this really got me, just the realization that like when Mama Coco dies, there is no overlap between the two of them. She will be the last person to remember Hector. So the moment she dies is the moment he permanently dies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they will never be reunited. Like it's just so well done in a way that's really hard to poke any holes. Like it all just kind of works together.
I also appreciate that like the movie doesn't necessarily let Hector off the hook either. Like it's not that like De La Cruz just like was so evil and ruined his life. It's like Hector did still make the decision to leave his family to be a musician. He was going to come back and like maybe it would have been fine if he did, but like he still did make the initial decision to like leave Mama Imelda behind to be a single parent, basically, you know? And and so, and like I really appreciate sort of the kind of the very realistic kind of ambiguity there of like there are some sacrifices that are made if you want to pursue an artistic career or something like that. And he did still make a choice and they still have to grapple with those choices. He was a lot more sympathetic than he was framed like by the family, but they do still have to kind of work that out. And the movie kind of lets that kind of happen naturally, that they do work it out, you know?
Well, and most of the family knows less about the story than Mama Imelda does, and Mama Imelda doesn't even know the whole story, you know?
Yeah, like,
right.
Yeah, it's man, it's such a cool story. But but I also totally derailed our music conversation, Stephanie. You're talking about the music. I mean, they had heavy hitters. I mean, I didn't realize all the people, even just until recently. It's not something I looked super heavily into prior until we were getting ready to talk about this. But I don't know that I ever took note of the fact that Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez of Frozen fame, and Robert Lopez specifically of Book of Mormon and Avenue Q fame, wrote songs for this. And then also Jermaine Franco, who scored and worked on a lot of the music for this movie, goes on to be the primary composer for Encanto, and I guess was the first woman to do so for a Disney animated movie, which is wild. So,
the first woman to do the music for a Disney animated movie? Like, I mean, ever?
It's so unbelievable that I read it a bunch of times and still don't believe it. Like, I'm quite certain that Jermaine Franco is the first woman to be the composer, like the composer, not composed for, you know, but to be the composer for a Walt Disney Animation Studios film.
That's good for her, but that is horrendous. Like, that is mind boggling.
As we record this, Encanto like just came out.
Good God.
It's wild.
Oh, wow. And you know what? And guess what? Everyone loves the music in Encanto. So like, maybe you should have done something like this sooner, Disney.
Yeah. It's also worth calling her out because even now, I know we're not talking about Encanto, but I mean, when people talk about the music of Encanto, they tend to talk about one person, and that's Lin-Manuel Miranda. They don't tend to talk about her.
Yeah.
And she's a huge part of it. But yeah, immensely heavy hitters. Like, it makes a lot of sense that the music hits the way that it does. Also, I guess initially, like, people sort of referred to Coco as Pixar's first musical, but it's not really a musical. It's a movie with music, and they sort of make that distinction. But I guess it was initially conceived as a musical. They were like, if it's going to be so centered around music, let's do a musical. Let's do our first musical. And it just, I think they determined it wasn't working right for this particular movie, and so we ended up with a movie with music.
Still the closest to a musical they've ever done.
And I'm fine with it because every song hits, you know.
It does, because you've got some, you know, you've got the sad emotional ones, but then you also have like the hype ones, like Un Poco Loco. Like,
oh my gosh,
that one's like one of my favorites.
That's the one song I do kind of know a little bit about because it's so fun. And if I understand correctly, it's about like loving somebody and being annoyed by them at the same time. Like, is that right?
Yeah,
it's
basically.
It's such a funny idea where it's like, yeah, I love you, but you annoy the shit out of me.
Oh, that's so real. That's so real.
I also love the song he sings when he's at the party, right? Like when he's walking down the steps. To go see De La Cruz, I think that was also really good. I just love the musical influences and just like I love mariachi music. So the fact that it was kind of more heavily showcased in this film, I thought was really, really neat.
Yeah.
No, I get the sense that mariachi is like the big musical style in Mexico. Is that right? The way that they talk about it, they kind of were like, and of course we had mariachi. Is that right?
I think in the region that they're featuring the film, because in the living world, at the very beginning of the film, he goes to Mariachi Plaza. Uh-huh. So Mariachi Plaza is basically, and it's featured in a lot of different cities, but essentially it's a plaza where a bunch of mariachi groups will hang out and then people can come and hire them, right? So like...
Oh.
That's typically what it can be like, right? So like if you need a mariachi band for a party or to go serenade someone, you go to a mariachi plaza and you're going to find a group and you're going to be like, hey, I'm going to hire you for my party. Let's go. And like they're ready to go. Because that's where he goes to go shine, you know, the mariachi's shoe.
Oh, I love that mariachi so much. Yeah. That's my favorite extra. I have such a crush on that mariachi.
And he's so nice to him. He's just I'll play guitar for me, my dude.
Yeah, but regionally, I think, yes, like it would be like the very popular one.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They, in a lot of what they talk, I know that they went all over Mexico, but a lot of what they talked about was Oaxaca. I'm probably butchering that. I'm so sorry.
No, that's right.
But,
no, it's
okay.
Right.
Okay, cool. That's what they talked about the most. So I'm assuming that a lot of what we see is not only Oaxaca, but like very specifically Oaxaca. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. That's my guess, at least. I don't know.
No, I think you're, yeah, I think you're right. Because this is like also a very small thing, but at the altar, they left like a plate of mole, which is like the brown chocolatey sauce mm-hmm. for as like as part of the altar. And mole, the way it looks and the color and consistency is different in different regions. So for it to be in Oaxaca, there is a typically like a darker, more chocolatey mole sauce versus like if they're going to go to a different region, it'd be more red or like orangey.
Okay.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that. The detail. That is so cool.
Right? That's just like one thing. But yeah, I think they probably just took most of the influences from that area, especially like the cemetery or like how the little town looks, you know, all of that stuff.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
One place that they visited that was really cool that I didn't, I see it now. And I feel like once you see it, you won't unsee it. There was some market that one of the art folks, one of the folks who was on a research trip, like sort of stumbled into. It was like it was like an open air market, but it was enclosed. Like it had a roof and everything. But there were so many folks grilling that this whole market was really smoky. And there was this sort of semi-translucent roof situation. So like light was coming through and hitting all this smoke and it created this sort of hazy look. Huh. And she was like, this is what I want. This is what we need. And when you go back and you watch, you can see that haziness just kind of throughout the movie, you know, even in like wide shots or small shots or whatever, just this general haziness inspired by this very one sort of serendipitous moment where she stumbled into this market where folks were grilling. It's really cool. This is a movie I feel like you could just watch over and over because of those details. Like you were talking about with the mole, Stefania. That's every time it's something new.
Yeah.
I also loved when at the beginning Miguel gives Mama Coco orange slices.
Uh-huh.
Like it's a very small detail, right? But like he's just eating an orange and then he gives Mama Coco like his half of the orange. I think that is just so cute and like wholesome and is very much like, you know, like it's like I could, like I've seen that happen, right, with family, like, or even with my parents, like, hey, do you want to have an orange, you know, like it's just like a little detail that I think was cute that they included.
And on the topic of Mama Coco, I love the design of her, all the work that they do with like all the wrinkles and everything on her face.
Mm-hmm. Oh my
like,
gosh,
she is like such a beautifully designed character. Like it's really like just the immense, like there's, it's a Pixar movie. There's detail in everything, but the immense detail in her specifically, which makes sense because she's like integral to this entire movie.
Yes.
Like you will never forget her after the end of it. Mm-hmm. So, but it makes sense. But even still, like just the amount of detail into just her character design and just like, she doesn't move a lot in the movie, but every movement that she does have feels so like deliberate and like well thought out and everything. And like, it just, everything about her is just like so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Even like the hair braids, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like I think that is, it really is just all in the details that they were able to include.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her hair braids, I don't know why they stand out to me, but the hair braids stood out to me too. Even just her clothes. Like, I love that she's just wearing like fuzzy slippers. I also love, there's like that one little short montage where Miguel is introducing his family and he introduces Mama Coco and it's just like, and I tell her everything. One of my favorite moments aww. In this movie and in like any movie is when Miguel is like, I used to run like this, but now I run like this and it's so much faster. I don't know why that gets me. It's the funniest thing. Because it feels so real.
It's such a 12-year-old thing. Yeah, it's exactly the type of, I remember talking like that to my grandparents and they were just like, they didn't care what I was saying. They just enjoyed that I was like there talking, that their grandson was talking to them and having some kind of fun, whatever he was talking about.
Yeah. It's so funny.
I think it's hilarious that Frida Kahlo is like in this movie and actually like important to like plot momentum.
Is she the only historical figure in this movie or are there other ones that I don't know about?
No, there's definitely other ones, but they are more in the background.
Okay.
So like when I mentioned before, Some of the skeletons at De La Cruz's party in particular is where you see some of these more like iconic figures.
Oh,
that makes sense.
So like when he's at the party, when De La Cruz is at his party and he's talking to certain skeletons, a couple of them represent some also like famous musicians and also actors. And it's very interesting because you can see, like, you can, they stand out because of the clothing that they were given, even though they're all skeletons, right? Yeah. Like, you're like, oh, like, that's so-and-so, or like, oh, a couple that I know of. One is, there's this very famous actor or comedian also. His name is Cantinflas, and he was at the party, and that's someone who you could see, like if you googled Cantinflas, you will recognize the outfit because he kind of has like a specific look. Mm-hmm. And so you can see that in one of the skeletons. There's also a couple other actors and musicians like Jorge Negrete, he's a singer, Pedro Infante, you know, like there's very famous iconic figures that like my parents were, or you know, family members can pull from based on how they were dressed at the party specifically.
Oh my god, now I'm looking. So I just searched, all I did was search Cantinflas Coco, and it's showing like entire breakdowns of certain scenes and like who those skeletons are.
Oh, that's so cool.
Dang. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be surprised because Pixar like does like we recently talked about Cars, and Cars litters like tons of like racing figures in there that I typically don't know either. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but like, damn, there are a lot of them. There's so many references that in just the party.
Yeah, the party in particular is when you see more of like the iconic other figures besides Frida, because Frida, you know, is pretty well known. But yeah, to incorporate some of these other ones, I thought was really cool.
Oh, the wrestler is based on somebody too. That wasn't just like a general reference to,
oh, really?
To like luchadors.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
I loved him. He was so cool. Okay, neat. I want to look into this more.
That's yeah. So cool. Oh, that's so cool. Frida, she's so funny in this movie. Like her that performance that she's like rehearsing is like simultaneously hilarious and like kind of unsettling.
It's very unsettling.
Yes.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah. No, I love that.
Yeah, when the skeletons first like crawl out of the seeds of the papaya, I'm like, oh no, no, not that. Oh, so funny.
I have a question, because this might be like a dumb, like a thing that I'm thinking too much into, and I feel like I've read it elsewhere before, so this isn't a wholly unique idea. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Clocked is interesting and maybe weird to me that one of very few movies from like a mainstream studio to be like very heavily focused on like on Mexico in general ends up putting like customs and like border patrol stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
Oh,
it makes sense in the context of the world of the movie, but it does clock is kind of weird like that. Mm-hmm. It's like feels like almost like, oh, of course you had to put a reference to that in there. I don't know. Like it just, I don't know that. I don't know if there is something there or not, I guess.
Yeah. Like when they try to cross for the Day of the Dead, right? They're at a checkpoint, right? And that's, I thought that was interesting. I also was thinking like in this world of the dead, like how do those skeletons have jobs? Right? Like how do who decides who gets jobs, or like why does that skeleton have to work, you know?
So here's something that was fascinating to me. They when they were figuring out their afterlife, they said they looked at tons of different cultures' afterlives, both specifically relevant to, you know, the culture they are portraying, but other ones as well. And they said, honestly, so many people that we talked to were just like, I don't know what it is, that they were like, it just kind of told us what not to do, right? So they just kind of create sort of their own rules, like rules for how the society worked. And one that really surprised me was somebody said, and this is, I guess, like actually manifested in the movie, but you'd never guess it, that the occupation you had in life is the occupation you have in death. And they said the reason they did that was so that Miguel would see that his family are still shoemakers, and it would motivate him further, and he would feel even more desperate to follow his dream, and then it would be even more significant to sort of accept his family's trade, knowing that if he never realized his dream in life, he would never realize it in death.
Oh,
and I was
God.
Like, that is so dark.
That's deep. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
I also don't know if you would pull that from watching the movie, right?
Like, no.
I don't see them making shoes in the land of the dead, right?
Like, I feel like a lot of the skeletons don't wear, well, I guess we don't see a lot of their feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
Hector doesn't wear shoes, but Hector doesn't wear a lot.
Yeah.
God, so
that's interesting.
Yeah, so all the customs officers were just customs officers in life, and that's how they got that job.
So that's why I brought it up, is like, who decides who gets what job? I mean, I guess that's just what they always did.
It's
so terrible. But it's definitely a question worth asking. I certainly get where it comes from, right? Because there's this idea of like crossing from the afterlife into the world of the living. But yeah, I wonder if there was a way that they could have done it different. I'm sure there is, but I wonder what they could have, how it could have manifested differently, as opposed to just looking like, customs checkpoint or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't really pay attention to that until I saw the movie again this week, just to like refresh. And because even one of the officers who's meeting with Hector, you know, because Hector tries to finagle the system so much that he's meeting with that officer in his office and is basically like, listen, I'm just going to give you a warning because I got to go see my family in the living, right? Like, oh man, like I was like, man, even in like death, like this poor skeleton man, you know, is having to like clock out at the end of the day and only has a couple hours to go see his family. Like, I was like, oh, that's kind of sad.
Yeah, it's so cruel.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Honestly, the closest analog that I see for the afterlife is like how the afterlife of Beetlejuice was, where it's just very like bureaucratic. Weirdly enough, like that movie was just very much like you have to file paperwork and get jobs and stuff in the afterlife, and it feels like analogous to that, which is sort of weird because otherwise this afterlife seems fun as hell in every other regard. It's just the job aspect and the actual like border stuff that's sort of weird.
I do think, I mean, the fact that you point out, Stefania, that it doesn't really, like, you wouldn't get it from the movie. It sounds like maybe it was just like the type of rule they made for themselves to determine like how do we even justify having people work. But yeah, you're right. Like, what if we just didn't? What if we just enjoyed our eternal death?
I know.
Yeah, it would take away as part of the plot, because like part of the reason is like Hector can't cross over, right? So you almost have to have sort of these, I guess, establishments, right, of like how their society runs, what are the rules, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Some sort of barrier there. Yeah.
It's a thing where it's like, you really can't think too much into it, because it's like, you have to have some kind of rules in the afterlife, and they give you they spell out enough of the very specific rules that matter to the plot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then everything else you could just kind of guess or not think about, and that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's well crafted by comparison to a lot of like fictional worlds that are just built from the ground up, you know?
Right.
What else haven't we talked about, if anything?
I feel like we covered a lot of the high points, or at least the things that stood out to me the most.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like you said, Derek, at the top of this, like, no notes.
it's so
good, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and it is, I mean, this is another thing that I think has come up with many Pixar movies, where we talk a lot in depth about this stuff and then almost forget to add, like, it's also very funny.
There's
a lot of really
funny
jokes in this movie. Like you mentioned, Doug, like Miguel, some of his very 12-year-old isms are always really funny. I like when he's just like, the afterlife's a real thing. I always thought it was like, you know, they're lying. Like, afterlife is real. Like saying like vitamins are real. They're like, vitamins are real. Well, now I'm thinking that maybe they are.
Yeah.
I also, on the topic of Miguel, like, his little like secret sanctuary hideout. Not that I had a secret hideout sanctuary to anything or anyone or a particular dream or anything, but there's something about it that just feels so relatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know.
Definitely. Yeah, especially with like all the posters and, you know, I mean, it's, I feel like growing up as a kid, right, I had posters of like my favorite boy bands or, you know, favorite actors. And so it very much reminded me of that, right, is like he, De La Cruz is his hero. That's his guy, right, and he's emulating him and you know, to create this space for him, right, where it's literally the only space he has for his creative outlet, right? Otherwise, grandma's going to come with the sandal, the chancla, and, like, you just never know, right? So,
Can I tell you, if anybody out there questions the idea that having people in the room from a culture you're trying to represent is important, if you're trying to question that, let me tell you something wild. The chancla was not, like, initially part of her, like, characterization, personality, and, like, part of the dynamic. They initially had her, they said, rule her family with a wooden spoon or whatever. She was always carrying around this wooden spoon. And then somebody who was a consultant basically said, hey, are there any chancla gags in this movie yet? Like, I think we should include that. And then they were like, huh? And he explained, like, yeah, no, like, it's a whole thing. And then a bunch of people in the room who were also consultants were like, yeah, like, you don't have a chancla gag? Like,
yeah.
And then it becomes such a big part of the movie. You see Mama Imelda does the same thing with her boot.
Yep.
That's so funny.
No, 100%. And, like, every family will relate to that because, like my grandma did that, right? So, like, yeah, very much is a prevalent thing and something that you can pick up on, right? Like, oh, of course, here she comes with the chancla. Like, you gotta watch out, especially with the mariachi. I think that one was the funniest.
Oh, so funny.
Yeah.
The consultant, when he was like, there's like a clip. It's weird that this moment was like caught on camera. It seems like almost too pivotal moment to be caught on camera. But it was, he was explaining to somebody what it was. He's like, it's like the belt, but like way worse. And you feel that when she's like storming through the plaza.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then he's like, Miguel, go get my shoe. Right. Like, he
funny.
So I was like,
funny.
All right, go get it.
Doesn't miss a beat.
Oh my God. It's great.
Speaking of his little hideout, we didn't really talk about this because I think it's an easy thing to take for granted, but just getting to see people's hands playing guitars and instruments in this movie is massive. It's such a difficult thing to even draw or depict an instrument, let alone somebody actively playing it and doing so accurately. Because even if you just think of people like actual human actors who have to act like they're playing an instrument they don't know how to play, like they obstruct their hands or they do, you know, wacky crazy things so you can't notice, like they can't pull that, or, you know, Pixar wouldn't, I guess I should say, do that in this scenario. So I mean, all that stuff is like, that's real playing, like that's them taking tons and tons of video reference and then animating it and then going back and looking at their reference and putting it side by side and making sure that like the vibrations of strings are happening in the right places on the strings. Like, it's incredible. And seeing Miguel play his instrument, those up close shots, is just like awe inspiring.
That's incredible.
It's wild. There were there was a guy, he was one of the music, I think a musical consultant maybe, who was like, it was amazing to see because that's somebody playing, but it's a cartoon. Like,
yeah,
like he was just amazed. And this is somebody who sees this every day, you know, just not as a cartoon.
That's wild. No, I'm always amazed at the type of things that they can do. I mean, you know, like Disney being this huge thing, right? And and Pixar and just all the things that they can do with the technology that they have, I just think is amazing. And so much kudos to the artists and creators, because I'm assuming that this took a very long time, right, to put together.
I think the pitch was in like 2011, 2012.
Oh, wow.
And then, I mean, you know, the animating wouldn't have been that whole time. But yeah, this is, most of these movies, you can trace the timeline back, you know, like 8 years or something. Mm-hmm. And then they always rework movies. That's the thing we talk about all the time. They're reworking things. So then animators and artists are having to redo things. So, I mean, you're right. It takes them a long, long time. You don't just like shoot a shot with a camera and then yeah. you know, call it.
Right.
I know I'm simplifying live action, but still.
Still. Yeah. No, yeah. I agree.
Here's my question to both of you. Mm-hmm. What are the points that you cried at in this movie?
Oh yeah, we gotta track that.
Yeah, because you know, there's the one big one, right? There's Miguel singing to Mama mm-hmm. Coco. That's mm-hmm. like you can't not, if you don't cry at that, I don't know what's wrong with you. I don't know how you can't not. like that's the main one. But I feel like there's got to be other ones for you all too.
Yeah, for me, in addition to that scene right at the end with Miguel, the one scene that gets me is it is towards also the end when Hector is starting to fade away mm-hmm. and he's just lying there and like Mamaya Melda's there and they're trying to send Miguel back to the living world. Just the way that they featured Hector kind of fading, like kind of essentially dying again mm-hmm. and then like Miguel being super upset because he lost his photo and now no one's going to remember Hector. But I think just whatever that conversation was and what they were saying for me kind of struck a little bit emotional. Because I think in a lot of ways, some of these films, like at least for me, like I start thinking about like my own family members, right, that like right. have passed away or like mm-hmm. how would that play out? Or, you know, you just start thinking about that stuff. Or also maybe that's just me because I also get super emotional attached to films. But for me, I think those were the top two. Yeah. And for sure, the part at the end, right, when he's singing Remember Me to Coco. Wow. And then she, you know, essentially kind of becomes alive in a way, right? Because yeah, she starts yeah. talking in a way that we hadn't seen before in the movie. You know, so I thought that was those were the two most emotional pieces for me.
Yeah. And that this thing with Mama Coco is like, that's also like such a real thing that happens, like that the way that music can like kind of bring mm-hmm. people to life, you know, and that's a thing that I think has been like well researched and stuff, that like people with dementia and Alzheimer's, like some ways that you can sort of like stay like in the present is with like with things like music, especially if it's attached to like a very significant memory or part of your life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I cry so easily if you put an animated movie in front of me, that if it's specifically even remotely trying to make me feel something, I cry. So
yeah.
I cried when Mama Imelda ruined his, or like destroyed his guitar that he made. I cried.
Yeah. That's really tragic too.
It is.
Yeah. I cried when he plays at the Battle of the Bands and it goes well. Mm. I cried when he gets caught by, you know, Pepito. I just so much throughout this movie that just yeah. makes me cry. I just openly yeah. weep. This is one of the Pixar movies I just openly weep watching.
Sure. And
for like good sad moments and triumphant moments.
Yeah. even beyond with Miguel singing to Mama Coco, I think then like soon after, like the second that you see her photo, like 1 year later, and like you realize,
oh
you know,
my god, that got me too.
Absolutely demolishes me, and I yeah. can't stop for the you know the last few minutes, and it's that's it.
Oh, yeah, from that moment till the end of the, like till it says the end, I'm crying
yes.
because you get
yes.
that where you realize that she has died, but then you also see her family. Yeah. accepting that and ready to celebrate her on the Day of the Dead, right? And then you hear Miguel singing to his whole family, you see his family members playing instruments.
Yeah.
Like it's just everything.
And then you see the ghosts, right? Or the skeletons, yeah. like they're there.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. No, I definitely forgot about that because when they're putting the frame down, right, of Mama Coco, and they just like stand there for like a second and pause. Mm-hmm. I think that is like yeah.
So good.
Yep.
So many moments. This movie, I mean, I mentioned, not that this is a measure of how good a movie is necessarily, but I mentioned it. It won nearly everything that it was nominated for. It is like vastly critically acclaimed. It yeah. frequently is near the top of people's personal rankings, like actual review critique type ranking. I mean, it's just a damn good movie. Uh-huh. It's just really freaking
so good.
Good.
Yeah, uh-huh. So good.
Yeah. And honestly, like a massive bright spot. Not that there's like a dark era of Pixar, but you know, the 2010s are weird because it's so many sequels and like a few original properties. And this and Inside Out, I think, really were, this one especially, because Inside Out was couched between a bunch of sequels. I do remember there being a bit of like a reaction to Coco that was simply just, okay, Pixar does, they have not lost their way, you know, like they, they're still making stories that just absolutely destroy and build us up. And so it's just, I think for so many people, for so many reasons, it hits on so many levels in so many ways. It's just good. If you listen to this whole thing and you still haven't watched it, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And I also feel like this is for me, this is kind of like a classic, right? Like when you look back, like from years from now, right? Like I feel like Coco is definitely a standout, like by itself. I don't know if they've like announced anything to do like a sequel for Coco. And I kind of hope that they don't, because I think it's kind of one of those films that is kind of precious in and of itself, right? Of like what it is. And, you know, I think they could do other stories, right? But like to do a specific sequel about Day of the Dead or about Miguel, I mean, it would be interesting, but I think keeping Coco of what it is, I think would be, for me, I think it can stand alone by itself.
Yeah. I would protect Coco and Inside Out with my life from them trying to sequelize them. And I tend to trust Pixar with sequels. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What's wild is with both of those examples, there are worlds like an Inside Out that is looking into like someone's mind, has a really beautiful fleshed out world. Coco, the afterlife. Both of those are things that I could see the worlds theoretically being explored more. Like it isn't to say that there's not room to do sequels, but I think that like,
of course,
it's just that they found the perfect stories to tell within those beautifully crafted worlds that like I feel like there's no way to not have diminishing returns. I would love to be surprised by that.
Sure.
But
and Pixar has done that before. They have surprised us in that way, you know?
Yeah. Right. It's just the likelihood of it, you know. I would prefer seeing another world that is fleshed out as the afterlife in Coco and the mind of Inside Out. Again, yeah. That's just a new fleshed out world that has a perfect story attached to it.
I mean, ideally, I would love to see Pixar do another movie that explores Mexico and its cultures in a different way, so that this isn't just the one Pixar movie that, you know, was a love letter to Mexico. And it is, but like, you know, one thing that Adrian Molina talked about in an interview was like the Book of Life came out and was being developed at like the exact same time, and he said, you know, as an artist, you're a little bit worried that like, oh shoot, did we stumble into something that was like too similar? And then he was like, but there are a million Christmas movies, why can't there be two movies about Day of the Dead? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
right.
And I don't know what Adrian Molina is working on at Pixar, but I do know that the guy who did Book of Life, Jorge Gutierrez, has largely dedicated himself to creating properties that celebrate Mexico and you know, Mexican stories and characters and stuff like that. So, I mean, he knows that you can continue to do it. So hopefully Pixar as an entire company knows that you can do it.
No, absolutely. And because there is just so much to explore, because in Mexico, the country, there's just so many different regions that are so different from each other, right? You have areas that are, you know, home to still indigenous cultures, right? Within Mexico, there's regions that are more metropolitan, right? You know, there's areas that are more tropical, like jungles and forests. And, you know, there's just so much to still kind of unpack and explore, because there is a richness to the culture, because there's just so much, there's just so many different traditions just within, you know, that population, that there's just so many different stories you could go through. Like, you could have a story about a quinceañera, right? Like, you know, like explore something like that, or what does that mean? Or just so many different layers that I think they would have so much to explore. And I hope that they keep continuing, right? Like, they now they have Encanto that features mm-hmm. more of the Colombian side of, you know, South America. And so, like, you know, featuring different cultures in that way, I think if they can keep doing that, I think that will be awesome.
I think that we will continue to see it. I know that Coco isn't solely responsible for this sort of wave of, like, unabashed cultural, like, love letters through animation. I know that mm-hmm. they're not solely responsible for it, but I really do think that they played a big part. Mm-hmm. Mexico loved this movie. It was the all-time box office, like, yeah. record holder. Like, above the Avengers when it came out. So
nice.
It's you know, the like you said, Stephanie, there's so much to explore and tap into, and it's when you do it right, it's appreciated. So
mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely.
I think we're in for more. I would be shocked if it just sort of ended because we got a few movies, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing it right now with a lot of like East Asian traditions. Every single major animation studio released some sort of movie that explored explicitly or specifically or sort of generally some East Asian culture or folktale or something in the past like 5 years. Every single one of them. So
true.
Yeah. So I think companies are learning that they don't need to be afraid of that, and that they never needed to be afraid of that. And I think that's only benefiting the breadth of stories that we're getting.
Yeah, I agree. And I think as you're, you know, for your studios, if you are hiring, right, newer animators, creators that are coming from diverse backgrounds, right, I think you're going to get that richness. And it's going to show, right, in the films that they make, mm-hmm. Which I think is important. And it's part of the aspect, right, because having these cultural consultants or, you know, the folks who are actually creating, you know, the animation, I think that all is going to play a role in like what we see in the future for some of these films.
Yeah. And it's, if you look through the credits, like you can tell they, you know, Moana came out a year before this and it's not quite as, you know, it doesn't necessarily nail that part as well, right? Like the actually involving creators, they did a lot of work, but they didn't do as much work necessarily as Coco did. And Coco probably maybe, I don't know, Pixar is a hard one because they do so much work on every film research wise. But like Coco maybe didn't do as much as, I don't know, like Encanto. Who knows? Like, I don't know. Like it just with as time goes on, right? Like I think they're learning better ways to do it, you know? And I think Coco is an example where two white people who were executives at the studio had an idea, and then they kind of had the right approach to how do we bring in people who then can go on and do their own thing now that they've gotten that experience and they've gotten really close to the process, you know? So
yeah.
Adrian Molina doesn't need Lee Unkrich next time to be like, hey, buddy, mm-hmm. you want to help me make this movie? He can just make his own movie.
Right.
So I look forward to whatever we have next. I know we're not quite at Turning Red, but I think it's notable that Turning yeah. Red in the real time is the most recent movie we got. Mm-hmm. And we don't typically do news either, but it's also notable that the director and producer of that movie were just recently elevated within Pixar. And I think there's definitely a through line from around now, this Coco yeah. era, to the actual real time now of 2022.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. For sure. So,
it's exciting. It's exciting stuff.
Yes, very much so.
Well, Stephanie, I like I said at the top, I'm so excited that you were able to join us. I hope we did the movie justice in our conversation.
No, this has been so fun. You know, Coco for me, it's special. It, you know, is something that was so new to see on screen as someone who is Mexican, and we, you know, have these traditions in our family, and to see that on screen was just really cool. And just happy to be here and talk about it. And yeah, honestly, if you haven't seen Coco, like, you should, because it's just good.
and how, come on, how have you, it's
yeah,
just go find it, go watch it.
Yeah, it's just cute. The music's great. You know, visually, it's beautiful. Like, just so much goodness, you know, from the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, thank you. I'm so happy. And I can't wait to track again kind of the effect that this movie has on everything going forward. So thank you again, Stephania.
Yes, thanks awesome. So much.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Well, if you enjoyed our conversation today on Coco and you want to hear Derek and I talk about all sorts of other things, we're doing all kinds of stuff. The first place I would have you check for things we're doing is our Patreon at patreon.com/wallopingwebsnappers. That's the name of our weekly podcast, Walloping Web Snappers. And check out our Discord. There should be a link in the show notes. It's primarily Spider-Man stuff, but we do have a little corner in our Discord just for Pixar movies. So check it out. If you can't find the link, just let us know. You can also find us individually doing stuff. Derek, where can people find you and the stuff you're working on?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Derek B. Gale. You can also find my other podcast, Gimmicks, which looks at the high concept, experimental, structure breaking gimmick episodes of television with a new show, a new guest every single week. And you find that anywhere you get your podcasts or on Twitter and Instagram at Gimmicks Pod. What about you, Doug?
You can find me on Twitter at Ickybooley, IckyBooley. You can also listen to me on another podcast called Victory Road. It's over on the Four Eyed Radio Network, and it's a Pokemon podcast where I talk about Pokemon with my friends just as I feel like it. And if you like books and video games, you can listen to me on a podcast called Novel Gaming, where my friends Katie, Vicky, and I catch up on all the media we've been consuming lately. I mentioned it just a moment ago, but if you want to check out our weekly podcast that Derek and I do, you can check out Walloping Web Snappers. It's a deep dive into every Spider-Man cartoon ever made, and you can find that weekly wherever you get your podcasts. Please visit our website at wallopingwebsnappers.com for a full archive of everything Derek and I are working on together, including Falling with Style. And you can follow us on Walloping Web Snappers on social media. It's the home of Falling with Style on social media on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Walloping Web Pod. Or you can email us specifically about Pixar movies at pixarpodcast@gmail.com. Please, if you like this podcast, rate, review, and subscribe on all podcast platforms, because if you like what we're doing, somebody else will too, and they just haven't found us yet. And those ratings and reviews make us appear in search results more frequently. So it's a very big help. And of course, we're not done yet. There are still many more Pixar movies to cover. Next month, we will be back with another sequel. A very long-awaited sequel, actually.
Yeah.
In The Incredibles 2.
Oh boy.
See you then.
See ya.